I'm Susan Brown.
I'm Michaela Joy O'Shea.
And I'm Jay Yee.
You're listening to Beyond the Fog Radio,
our podcast about the untold stories of San Francisco's long history from the people that have helped shape it. Whether you're new to San Francisco or have lived here your entire life, join us as we share the stories of our city by the bay.
So you guys, I am so looking forward to this interview because I love clothing. I love fashion. I love fabric. I love accessories. I love clothing.
Yeah, you have four closets, Susan? Is that right?
I have seven closets and they're all full.
Holy moly. Yes.
It's impressive. It's so impressive.
Believe me, I work at it.
I mean, every time we go to an interview, both Susan and Michaela are fantastically dressed every time.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Jay.
Yeah. You know, and I'm more utilitarian.
But, you know, that's suitable to your profession. And when you need to dress up, I mean, you got a suit game that's pretty high.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I love suits. You know, don't tell everyone. I guess this is going public. I love suits, yeah. Guys. I love the details of suits. I love what they line the inside with suits. I just learned about some new suits from our previous interview with, what's his name?
Stanley?
Wilkes Bashford.
Oh, Wilkes Bashford.
Yes.
Oh.
Which then informed my recent suit shopping for my brother-in-law's wedding. So I started looking for all these different brands going, oh, maybe I can try out this suit. It doesn't have to be just this brand. It could be the other brand.
So as they say in the fashion world, who did you try on?
Oh, I can't tell.
You can't? Okay.
No. Here's what I really loved. There's this Armani suit that is not navy, but it's called medium blue. Mm. And it looks so good.
Yeah.
Ooh. And more importantly, it looks so good on Jay.
There you go.
But they didn't have it because I didn't give enough leeway to order it in time. So I ended up buying a navy suit. And it was fantastic, but it wasn't this medium blue.
But it has to be comfortable, right? Because, I mean, I'm all about comfort in clothing.
You know what I've learned? The phrase is, it's all about how it drapes on you, honey. Mm.
Sure thing, honey.
Nowadays, when we think about athleisure, we think about brands like Lululemon, we think about Athleta, but it all started here in San Francisco in 1981. Julie Weston started her boutique on 22nd and Alabama in the Mission District, had it for many, many years, and spent the last 12 years on Valencia Street, which is now a huge fashion boutique quarter. She designed fabrics, she designed the clothing, and she manufactured them right here in San Francisco. On a side note, did you know that San Francisco had a huge garment manufacturing industry? As a matter of fact, it was tied into the immigrant community, specifically the Chinese American community, and it was happening until more recent years. Julie Weston's garments has been worn by so many people, from Madonna to MC Hammer, and here's the reason why. Her clothes were built for dancers. This is a brand where you can move, you can shake, and you can look fantastic all at the same time. She was cutting edge. She was the one that brought Lycra to the scene. Here's our interview with Julie Weston.
My name is Julianne Weston, and I had a clothing company for 38 years in San Francisco, all made in San Francisco. The name was Weston Wear. And we later changed the name to Weston San Francisco to give it the provenance that it deserved. And I closed it down about 5 years ago, 4 or 5. Time kind of flies by.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, congratulations for such a long run.
Woohoo!
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, but we want to go right into what happened between the beginning and where you are today.
A long time. I hope I can remember.
Are you born here in San Francisco?
I was born in Marin and raised in the far East Bay. So Walnut Creek, Pleasant Hill, Lafayette area, right in the middle of those three towns.
Not too far.
Where I grew up, yes.
How was life out in the far East Bay, you say?
Oh, well, it was lovely. We used to come to San Francisco, I remember in the 60s, and we would put on white gloves. You know, really? I was 6-7 years old, but white gloves, and my mother would wear the hat, and we'd come to the city to eat in Chinatown. Uh-huh. Johnny Cans was a popular spot we used to go to all the time. And Danny Kaye, the celebrity, used to sometimes show up and cook in the kitchen. I just love Danny Kaye. And so people are going, who's Danny Kaye?
That's amazing.
So, and my favorite place was the Wax Museum. So
we'd,
you know, come here on my birthday to go to the Wax Museum in Chinatown because I love shopping in Chinatown.
So. I love it.
Yeah. So that, so San Francisco was always kind of in my heart.
Yeah.
And this is such a beautiful place. I just love it.
And those were the days where you dress up to come to the city.
That's right. The white gloves and the hat. My mother had a whole slew of hats. And, you know, that's what they would, she would wear her best hat and the gloves and dressed up to come to San Francisco to go to dinner or brunch. We did a lot of brunches.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And were you always into fashion? Really?
Yeah. My oldest sister was 10 years older than I was. I had four siblings and my mother loved fashion and I was next to the youngest. And so she went through two daughters and a son and then it got to me. It's like my mother played the piano. She took ballet and she loved fashion. And all three I loved. So, so she and I were shopping buddies and we'd always go out shopping and always stop at the A&W, get a root beer and a burger. You know, here I am 8 years old and I'm like, let's go shopping.
I love it.
I started sewing at age 8.
And no kidding.
I've never been a real patient sewer, so I love things that you can sew really fast. And then if it had a zipper or anything, I'd make my sister or my mother put it in because I just didn't want to have anything to do with that, the details, you know. I just wanted the thing done. And
just get it done, Mom.
Get it done, right?
You're the idea person.
Right. I would like throw fabric out and, you know, start cutting. I remember the senior ball came and my mom said, okay, let's go to the store. You can make a dress. And I check out the fabrics, all the fabrics. The one fabric that I happened to like was an Italian fabric that was this is back in, 1974, $36 a yard.
Wow.
My mother's looking at me like, are you kidding me? She goes, you can have one yard, she said.
Whoa.
So she let me buy it. And I throw the fabric out. My mother, leaves the room. She can't take it. So I made a dress. You know, it had a long skirt and the halter. You know, halters were really big. So I would always go to the most expensive fabric. Fashion was always in my blood.
Yeah, you had the taste for it right away.
Yeah.
Was that fabric that you bought in San Francisco or out in
That was in the East Bay.
Oh, but, where was that? I lived out there, too.
I think it was, Concord. Okay.
Pleasant Hill.
Pleasant Hill Concord area. Maybe in Montgomery Ward's, where that used to be.
I'm surprised. I'm shocked that they had nice fabric out there.
Back then, the fabric stores were plentiful.
Really?
And they'd have a full range of choices.
Was it common to make your own dress to go to prom?
Absolutely.
Really?
My girlfriend, Susie, she's actually a very prominent interior designer, Susan Chastain. Uh-huh. She and I would make all of our prom and senior ball outfits, and we'd come to school and we'd be wearing kind of the same thing all the time, you know, without even checking in with each other. But another thing in the 70s was getting because you're coming off the hippie movement, we would get the Indian bedspreads, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we would cut them into, you know, those
pants,
long skirts or the palazzo pants.
Hold on. What are you talking about?
What's an Indian bedspread?
Jay and I are confused. An Indian bedspread?
Okay, you know, like at Cost Plus, you'd get these bedspreads that were made in India, and they're batiks. Batik print.
Oh.
Literally from India.
Madras or whatever. Yeah.
So, multicolored with gold.
Yeah, so you've seen probably like Indian shirts or whatever, cotton. Yeah, so this would be a big cotton bedspread, and then we would cut it and make it into garments.
Amazing. Yeah.
Like a skirt or a palazzo pant.
Yeah, and a halter.
And a halter top. Everyone did that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And the halters were easy because it was a triangle. Yeah. And then with a tie.
Exactly. You tie it up.
And then the skirts were usually fluted or A-line. And I remember wearing that outfit one time, came to the city with a bunch of kids from high school, and it was 80 degrees at night. It was like the most unusual evening in San Francisco, and I was wearing the halter top and the skirt, and it's like, this is amazing, you know, so warm in San Francisco in the evening.
Don't need a jacket.
Right, that was very unusual.
Yeah, very unusual. So tell us a little bit about from college.
Yeah, so I went to school at UC Davis, and they had a design department there. And at first, I was a music major for the first year, and I played the piano. And we got into sight singing and all this like really difficult harmony, you know, the
music theory.
Thank you. Very difficult. I had studied music theory all my life. But it got into the real advanced stuff, and I'm like, this is not where I want to be. So I was into dance, and also decided to go into the design department, which was really open. You could take whatever you wanted in humanities, or you just needed a certain amount of units. And so I did that, and I specialized in kind of the art to wear, because that's what the design department, they had a textile department, so I learned draping and drafting patterns and textile science. I took those three classes in the textile department. So anyway, graduated with that. And then I wasn't finished with the dance. So I went to Stanford to study with this woman who had studied with Mary Wigman, who was a pioneer in modern dance in Germany. So I went to study with Inga Weiss at Stanford and get a dance education degree.
Wow.
So I got a master's in education with a dance emphasis. And after that, I came to San Francisco, continued to dance, but I had met a woman who had an overlock machine, and I found this fabric, cotton lycra, in 1980. And it was like, I thought, this is the fabric of the future. It's like plastics, you know? So I went to LA with this woman that had the overlock machine, and we found a jobber who dealt with cotton lycra, and he would get little bits, ends, and pieces from mills and stuff. So we bought the cotton lycra from him and came up, and I made leggings. And then I went door to door to stores. I want to buy a legging. And sold my first legging to a store called Andrea's, 3 bags full in the East Bay on College Avenue. And from there, I sold to Jean-Marc downtown. They were my idol. Jean-Marc, they had the most beautiful store downtown.
Wow.
They bought some leggings, and so that's how I started out.
Right.
What year about was that?
1981.
1981, okay.
Yeah.
And that's, I was told by our dear friend Annette that you were the first person to actually use fabric.
Yeah, it was a pretty new fabric on the market. There was a woman in L.A., Marika. I think the company's still going, and they did exercise wear, and Marika used cotton lycra. And then I remember I found it at Britex downtown. Mm-hmm. And I saw the fabric, and I'm like, oh my God, it was like $3.50 a yard, which was normally cotton was a dollar something. And so I said to the woman who was the buyer, I think it was Charmin, her parents had owned Britex. I said, could I buy some of this fabric? And she said, oh yeah, you take it all. People don't know what it is, and they don't know why it's so expensive. So I bought a bunch from her.
Wow.
And it was hard to find. So I just had to research around, and I found another jobber. The problem with buying fabric is that when you're starting out, if you're going to buy it from the mill, there's a minimum. So you have to buy, 100 yards or whatever the minimum is for them to do a run.
Right.
And so I would try to find these jobbers, which are middlemen. They would buy the ends of
the extras.
The extras, and then they resell it.
I see.
So that was what I did a lot, is I found a jobber in Brooklyn. Their warehouse was in Brooklyn, Norbrook Industries, and the gentleman, Arye, who I never met, I needed black cotton lycra, because by this time I had made a line of clothing and I started to get some orders. I'd gone to the boutique show in New York. I sent a friend of a friend who had that experience, and she went there and came back with $15,000 worth of orders. And so, okay, nice. Now I've got to get fabric. How am I going to get fabric? So I found that Norbrook Industries and REA, he says, I can feed you, I think it was like 100 yards a week of black cotton lycra, because that was like gold, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Or 50 yard, whatever it was. And so, because I needed it right away, I called all the customers. I said, I need a 2-week extension or whatever it was to give me more time. Got that fabric from the guy in Brooklyn, and that's how I got my first big order out.
So we're talking 1981.
Yeah.
So
this is like about 1984. I'm kind of moving along.
You're moving along.
Yeah, okay. To try not to drag the story.
The age of like leggings and athletic wear starts and all of that. So would you say that you were kind of in the beginnings of all of, where did this style come from? Did this trend come from here, from New York?
Or? Well, okay, I was a dancer. So yeah. I was in leotard and tights. That's what they called it back then. And it was all nylon. So mm-hmm. you're wearing nylon all day long. Yeah, sweating in the nylon.
Ew.
And this is the kind of crusty nylon.
Oh, my God.
Like yeah, your feet. So once I saw this cotton lycra, I'm like, oh, my God, the fabric of the future. I just thought this was really it.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine said, I don't want to wear tights. I want something looser.
Yeah.
So I made these pleated pants. They had pleats in the front and a little bit of gather in the back. And then a big waistband that I made it asymmetrical, so you would fold it over, and then the pants were kind of loose, and then they tapered down.
Oh yeah!
So that was the pant that
the beginning of, like,
I made that
pants?
for like 30 years. You know, it's like
wow.
People kept asking, "Yeah, can I order?" You know, because I did special order back in the day, and so people still wanted it forever and ever. And then I did a jodhpur pant that was not as full at the top. They had pockets. Pockets are very important. It's like when there's no pockets in a skirt or a pant, it's like you're like, where's my, like this. I have no pockets in the front.
Yeah, where are your pockets?
Anyway, for fashion, right? We do it for fashion.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then, of course, we needed a top to go with it. So I made this polo top. It had a little split collar and then the shoulder pads. And then it had a bat wing, and then it was like a shirt tail. Short on the front, and the back was longer.
Long, yeah.
So you could tuck the front of...
Like a French tuck.
Yeah, French tuck, and then the back hung out. So that was our...
So cool.
That's our
really
big
cool.
Look.
And this was just influenced by you wanting something comfortable
as a dancer. What did we want?
It wasn't like Paris fashion.
No. Well, you know, you're looking at Paris and everything. Mm-hmm. You're checking out, you know, what everybody else is doing. And, but this is what I'm going to make, because I want to be able to... wear something that's comfortable, but yet stylish, and where the knees don't bag, you know, because of the lycra.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look stylish, you know, so it's stylish, comfortable, and whatever the other thing
is. You can move it.
You can move in it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then from there, I would do these home parties. Friends of my mother, they'd all get together and serve a little wine, a little, you know, cheese and crackers. And I would take a rack of clothing, and then everybody could try everything on because it was all stretchy.
Wow.
And I did these circle skirts with the big waistband, again, the asymmetrical waistband, or sometimes just a flat waistband, circle skirts. And then we did a tulip skirt, and then with the polo top, and then we had a couple other style. Oh, we did a raglan top that was a little more fitted, but still, you know, in the waist and out. And then I started to do some prints, a local printmaker, Pandemonium, I think was one, and Zoo Ink. They did prints for me, hand silk screen prints.
Wow.
So I could get, you know, a little bit of action on the fabrics. It wasn't just flat.
Wow. And this was close here in the city?
Those are all in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would order, and then I'd get their money. And then in 2 weeks, I'd make everything up and then ship it to them.
That's so fast.
So that's really cool.
So,
that's
amazing.
Are you designing these prints as well, or do you have a separate
designer? So I designed the prints. I did like a, you know, fingerprint, and then I did a cat print, a bunch of cats, and then polka dots, stripes. You know, stripes I would find. Sometimes you could find stripes.
Striped lycra.
Yeah. And so then I, you know, starting to get some volume going, so I needed to order fabric pretty regularly. I found a company called Elastic Fabrics of America.
Yay!
Out of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Wow.
And so I wanted to order from them. I think their minimums were 800 yards. So this is when things are getting going.
Yeah, that's a lot of fabric.
A lot of fabric. And so they would use a factor to handle the finances, and the factor would approve or not approve to give you credit. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, their factor was very mean. I remembered his name up until now, and I can't remember, Mark something. He wouldn't even take my phone call. You know, I was like to try to get some kind of credit.
Yeah.
So what I did was I bypassed the factor. I went to a friend of my dad, had worked at a bank. It was one of his banker friend. So I went to their bank, and I would put money that I would borrow from friends and family, I put it in a CD in the bank, and then I would write a direct letter of credit from the bank to the mill, bypass the factor. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't building any credit, but I was able to get the fabric. So I had the money sitting in the bank in case I defaulted, and then they would make the fabric, ship it to me, and then I'd pay them back. And then I had these loans that I was getting from people, friends of friends, family members.
That's amazing.
With a high interest rate.
Is this all people that you've gone to these house party things, or how?
Sometimes.
And
even sometimes people I never met, but they would be friends of friends, but they'd have some money lying around and they wanted to get a high interest rate. And so I would write up an agreement that I would pay them back. 1 year, blah, blah, blah. I would always pay them back on the day.
Yeah. But obviously they believed in you too, right? It wasn't just about the
money. Yeah, so it was recommended by a friend or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Your style.
That's amazing.
That's so amazing.
Well, back then there was no, you couldn't get credit cards like you can get them today.
Or Kickstarter.
There was nothing like that.
None of that.
This was my Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And it was the only way I was able to finance, because it takes time to get the stores to pay you back.
Yeah.
And it was before I had a factor, my own factor, who would finance. And then I later met through the Design Network, which is a group early in the 80s of many designers in San Francisco. And then they would have people come and talk. And one time they had Gateway Acceptance out of Alamo or San Ramon. And they were factors where they would lend you the money for the goods that you would ship.
Mm. Okay.
So that was later after, you know, I did all this creative financing when I was able to get a factor. But they wouldn't guarantee, that's what it was. They were a factor where they wouldn't guarantee, like if the person defaulted that you shipped to, they wouldn't guarantee that I would lose the money.
Okay.
Or I had to go after them directly.
So this was risky.
Yes. So later on, I got a factor who would guarantee, like they would approve of a store that I was shipping to, and then I would ship the store. If they defaulted, then my factor would go after them to get the money. And so.
But I love how you got your friends and family and people you didn't know to give you money.
Right. And then if they wanted their money back, sometimes they would push it over for another year. And if they wanted it back, I would find somebody else to lend that same amount of money.
Yeah. So they were also investing in you.
Exactly.
As well.
Well, yes.
To a certain extent.
More emotionally, you know.
Yeah.
But that seemed to work out at the time. You know, I wasn't afraid to go. And I mean, people can always say no.
Right.
And that was something in the beginning I learned to ask, you know, if I didn't know anything, I had a rep in L.A., they would call me and say, oh, you know, Macy's was in and they want 15% off of the discount. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, and then I'd say, I'll call you back. And so I'd call my mother. I'd get her advice. I'd call friends, Andrea Rachels, Caroline from Cut Loose, and Cut Loose is still going, only she sold it. But I would call them because they had, you know, more savvy than I did. And I would ask them the question, they'd give me advice, and then I'd call back my rep and I'd give them my answer. So I'd always say, you know, hold it, I'll call you back.
And then
you have to kind of wing it. I didn't grow up in a Garmento community. So it's like I had to learn kind of on the fly.
Yeah.
And,
but you were very creative with how you built everything. I mean, just like Susan said, you know, getting all of the people to help you out. I have a lot of respect for you because we're we also have small businesses, right? And there's a hustle, but your hustle was so much more intense.
Yeah.
And so much more, yeah, there wasn't, there
weren't
support systems for creatives
then. The whole dynamic was different back then, yeah. You know, so that I could do that and that people, I think, were a little bit looser with their money.
Yeah.
And there wasn't the whole credit card aspect. However, I remember going, I just saw this on TV where they were saying in 1973, I think it was the first time that women could get a credit card.
Really?
Is that correct?
Really?
I thought,
yeah,
I saw that.
That seems familiar.
I saw that on TV and I went, wow. Because when I was a freshman in college, there was a desk set up, Bank of America, and they were handing out credit cards.
Really?
And I got a credit card with a $100 credit. And I just thought, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that that was actually
a new thing.
Oh, a new thing.
Yeah, that was a new product that the bank was trying to put out.
Yeah.
And they focused on students.
Right.
Right. Which is sad.
Which we later, you know, knew that Bank of America's had issues. Which, yeah, you know, later the students say, Bank of America, you don't want to, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, credit cards screwed me over.
But, you know, I just thought that, I thought it was so great. It's like, yeah. Woo, you know,
I got free money.
Yeah. And also building credit is, right, I later found out, very difficult, right, especially with this factor. Mark Christensen, that's his name. Mark Christensen wouldn't even take my phone call to discuss.
Really?
Yeah. It was like a lot of times factors would work with you somehow, give you a little bit of credit to build. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he wouldn't even have anything to do with
me. Was that because you didn't have like a brick and mortar store?
Yeah, no, I had no collateral.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wanted to have a conversation to try to start building some kind of collateral, you know? So that's why I went and did this creative, because there's a standby letter of credit. It's like an ongoing letter of credit that you can get. And I could not qualify for that because that's what they told me. You can do a standby letter of credit, but I couldn't do that for some reason because I had no credit. I can't remember exactly why. That's why they said, oh, well, you can do a direct letter of credit. So I had to go through that every time I had an order coming up. I had to do this whole letter of credit, you know, do the form with the bank, get the money, put it in a CD to guarantee that direct letter of credit. But, you know, at least it was a way to get the fabric.
Absolutely. I find this incredibly fascinating. Do you too? I didn't realize that you had to, because it would be orders from, I read your Macy's and Nordstrom and Neiman Marcus. Yeah. So these big.
Anthropology,
my personal.
Well, that
favorite.
Was later on. Later. So later, by that time, I got the gateway acceptance factor. And then later, I got, you know, real factors, you know, capital factors. And, you know, we had a couple of different factors we worked with. But that's when we had enough credit and we were able to sign up with
the workflow.
The big guys.
Was going, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You had a rapport.
But in the beginning, you were doing all of this creative.
Yes.
Creative financing.
Because I did have Nordstrom and I did have Macy's orders coming in the beginning.
Can you tell us about how you got that?
Well, so when I first did that boutique show, I had a friend of a friend who said, oh, this friend of mine, she's been a buyer, blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, you got to do the boutique show. That's the one to be in. So I made the line of clothes and I sent her off to do the boutique show.
This is the Lycra line.
Yes. This is like the first time that I did the whole thing, the pleated pants, the tulip skirt. And then she hired a gal to walk around in the clothes and had the number of the booth and all this.
Oh, cool.
And so she's calling me back and saying, this is what I'm doing. It's going really great. And so then, meanwhile, we had the Golden Gate Apparel show, which was happening at the gift center here. So I thought, oh, I'm going to go. And I had a San Francisco rep. I'd had one for maybe 2 years or 3 years. So I go to that show and I walked around and I got all dressed up in the clothes. And my San Francisco rep was showing there. And I'm walking around. I was all inspired by this New York show happening. I think it was happening at the same time. And I came around. This woman said to me, she goes, oh, I love your outfit. Who makes it? I go, well, I do. She goes, well, do you have a rep in Los Angeles? I said, no, I don't. She goes, would you like one? I'm a rep in Los Angeles. I said, sure, that sounds great. So I went over at the end of the show. I grabbed the line. I said to the San Francisco rep, you're fired.
Wow.
And I gave it to this woman. And because she was very enthusiastic, I thought, this is great. So her name was Carmen. And so she was with Novalina. And so she took it to, she had a partner in Los Angeles, Teresa Hagen. who I ended up, she was my rep for 30 years.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Things happen. You know, it's like I was looking for something and right. I didn't know what was going to come up, and that came up.
Was that the big break?
That was the big break. And then they immediately got Macy's and Nordstrom.
Wow.
Yeah. Because, you know, they had a showroom, and then, you know, all the department stores would cruise around and check out things. And if something looked good, they would buy it.
Yeah. So, and I imagine that's how Neiman Marcus and Anthropology started to...
Yeah, that was later on, actually, because Anthropology really didn't come about till the 2000s, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was a rather new concept store.
Okay.
Anthropology. They came around later. Neiman Marcus, I've kind of been in and out. I've done their catalog often. Mm-hmm. And then a few times, or towards the end, later part of my career, we did their... They have their boutique and their contemporary line boutique upstairs. And we were in there a bit. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Now you also had
Oh yeah. And Saks Fifth Avenue and Barney's. That's another story.
Of course.
Oh, Barney's.
Yeah. Barney's.
So you were in Barney's. That's incredible.
Yes. But you know, they were notorious for not paying.
Yes.
That was another story. I mean, they put people under, you know, like I remember Celia Tejada. She had a couple of stores default, and then Barney's, I think, filed Chapter 11 at one point and caught her. She had a huge amount with them, and I think that was kind of the demise of her company. That was very...
No.
Well, they got what was coming to them. I mean, they're over now, right? Barney's is dead, right?
Yeah, they're no longer.
Oh, yeah, they're...
But such a great store.
I know, it was
a great store. Time.
But, but to get them to pay, they would place an order, and I'd call. I found out the name of the guy that released the money. I would call, I'd say, we're a young, you know, small company and you have another order coming in and I really can't ship it until I get a check from you. So you'd have to do that. You'd have to just chase the money.
Jeez.
Which you're good at.
It's kind of necessity,
right?
You have to. I mean,
as an artist, artists usually aren't good at that. Artists aren't good at being like, I am worth this much and I need this much money.
Right.
So I'm good for you. That's great.
But yeah, that's business.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's not necessarily art.
Yes.
So the art end of putting yourself out there, I don't think I'm that good at. But the business end, it's like when you have bills to pay and you got to have money that has to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One time I found this really great company called Alden, Curtis and Michael. And they were like a collection agency out of New York or something. And they must have been like, Alden, Curtis, and Michael, we're going to come and, you know, kneecap you. Yeah, because they were so good. And they, somebody had recommended them to me. And they were ruthless. They would be able to get money out of companies that were known to never pay back.
Wow.
You know? Yeah, so.
Got them on your side.
Yeah. One time I had an order with Gantos. It was a department store, I think, in the Midwest. And it was $120,000, I think it was. And something happened. I don't know if they filed or what happened, but I sent the thing to Alden, Curtis, and Michael, and they went in there and negotiated the heck out of it. And I got some money back out of the deal. Those guys, I don't know what they did, but they were very effective.
Amazing.
And then later on, you know, it sort of dwindled because things would change and morph the way business was taken care of and everything.
So I'm going to ask a different question, same topic, but different question. Where did the manufacturing happen with Weston Ware?
Yeah, so everything happened in San Francisco. So we did some of the stuff in-house, 900 Alabama Street.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was there for 22 years.
Here in the Mission.
In the Mission, yeah. First, it was a co-op. There were several people that owned the building that lived there, and then a shift happened, and then they kept selling to each other until there was just a couple left and one renter who wouldn't leave. And so as people left, I would take over more space. Anyway, so as we would get orders and everything, I would find a contractor in town. And so we worked with certain contractors in the city as needed. And so some...
Towards to support with your production?
Yes, to support the production. At the peak, I had about 60 employees. We had bought a contractor at one point, and we were going to bring them in-house, and we ended up buying a building down the street from 900 Alabama at 550 Alabama. We renovated it, and we moved in, and it had a third floor that you could add on possibly. Mm-hmm. So we thought, we'll bring in the contractor and we'll put them on the third floor. Well, by the time it was like 4 years long, we finally got the permit happening and the plans, and we had done remediation for earthquake and everything on the building. And at that point, we had grown out of the building. So my husband always got lunch down the street, and they came back, and we had been looking around at other buildings to possibly purchase. And he came back, he said, you know, there's this building. It's kitty corner from where we get lunch. It has a big for sale sign, but it's huge. So we looked into it. It was 37,000 square feet.
Oh, what?
It was, but it was being sold by the owner, and he wanted to carry the financing. I mean, the whole thing was like waiting for us.
Wow.
He'd been trying to sell it for 3 years. His real estate agent was like ready to get rid of him. So we worked out a deal and we moved into this. It was old Challenge Creamery building.
Built that's amazing.
In 1932.
Wow.
18th and York Street. And it's a big corner building. I even have a picture of it from 1932 with all these Model A's pickups all like on, you know, on the drive-up doors and everything.
Super cool.
Yeah.
But what a beautiful building that was. That was the star of the show. And then we just occupied it for a brief moment. But
yeah.
Oh, really? How long were you there?
We were there probably, I think, 7 years, 7 or 8 years.
Did you really grow then? Were you biggest then?
At that point, we had grown out of the previous building, and the downstairs was just busting the shipping and all the fabric and everything. So we moved into that building after renovating it and getting it ready. Both of them had been originally food.
Hmm.
But yeah, both buildings. So it was kind of a similar building, cement, and and it had a 43 parking garage down in the basement.
Amazing.
So we would rent to all the neighbor people and everything. Yeah. I mean, it was just a beautiful building. That was really cool.
How many people did you have working for you then?
Oh, so we had about 60 people at the peak, and then later we ended up at about 30 people, and that was kind of towards the end.
Yeah. And this was all local San Franciscans?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you have anyone seek you out from like LA or New York or anything like that
to come work with you? If people moved to town, you know, it was always great to get someone fresh because they're usually, you know, hot to go. And so we would hire some people.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You decided to manufacture and produce everything here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And during the 80s and 90s, like you said, you at some point you would bring in contractors.
Right.
Now, San Francisco has had a big industry in the garment making sector. For quite some time.
Yes.
Can you speak to that?
Yes. Well, that is interesting you bring that up, because back in the 60s, I think there was quite a large manufacturing industry here, similar to New York, where clothing was like the number one manufacturing industry in New York City. But you could see it just slowly, slowly shrinking over time. So I just watched it shrink and shrink, get smaller, smaller, smaller. People leaving and closing down. And so I knew there was going to be an ending to what I was doing, and I was just going to play it out.
Sure.
And
at that time when that manufacturing was happening, what part of town was that mostly taking place?
Well, south of Market and Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Chinatown was a big, big player. And then it moves to south of Market, and then later South San Francisco.
Okay.
Some Oakland manufacturers as well.
Yeah.
So, and we actually, at the very end, we ended up selling our building and we moved to South San Francisco.
Okay.
To Oyster Point.
Yeah.
And had a space about 11,000 square feet there. And then we sublet part of that, and we sublet another part. You know, so at the end, we just kind of got smaller and smaller. But we did it, we downsized it. And I met this woman who is like a life coach, and she really helped me unwind the whole thing, which I thought I'd be continuing to make clothing and having a company forever and ever. And so she helped me kind of unwind the whole company in a really positive manner. I'm so grateful to be able to do that, because I was just like, I was going for it. I was on the locomotive, just going. And so she helped me get off that train and really kind of broaden my mind a bit and open my heart and just let things kind of fall as they may.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So.
And so where does your creativity bring you now?
Good question. I'm still seeking that. So I've continued to work with this woman, Jerry Shobe, and I'm studying clairvoyance with her.
Wow.
And really kind of going inward and everything. And so things, just all those things that I really needed to do and all that have been slowly falling away. I have a hoard of fabric. I've got all the fabrics. I've been selling off fabrics, and it's getting down to this like distillation of really, really cool fabric.
Wow.
And I've been making one-of-a-kind things. I worked with a local vintage seller, and I was transforming vintage into, like, morphing it into new product. I did that for a little while. And so now I'm just kind of like going through fabrics, piecing things together. I'm making kind of Frankenstein clothing.
Oh.
And just getting things that are really cool and making these funny things.
That's awesome.
And are some of these things here? So we're here in your, this is your studio.
No, this is kind of my way station.
Okay.
But my studio is in the Mission. I just moved to a new studio. So it's a big pile of fabric right now and a bunch of rack parts.
Okay.
So I'm about ready in about a week or so go in there and be able to put it back together. And I had 3 sewing machines and a cutting table.
And so what do you do here?
Here it's Pilates, workout, massage, and then I have a rack of clothes that kind of come and go of what I've made and things that are coming out of my closet. And because I was also hosting the Makers Fair.
Oh, cool.
Over in Dogpatch. I did, and yeah. I was in a studio over there. And so I was hosting a fair where we had artisans come and sell stuff on a Sunday. This is during the pandemic, outside, like even in the wintertime. It was, yeah, it was really fun. I enjoyed it. And I would take, you know, a couple racks of clothes. And at a certain point, I got it down to maybe just jewelry. So it's funny because people say, oh, you should start a business and do the ball. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of did that. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So I've done that. So I'm just, you know, I think I'm going to start a band or something.
There you go. Go back to music.
Yes. I'm going to take some drum lessons from a good friend of mine and do a little drumming.
Oh,
and
that's great.
There you go. Yes.
I love that.
So I'm, you know, just kind of trying a bunch of different things. And it's like when I think of starting something, another business or company, I'm just like, I don't have it in me. So I'm just kind of going with the wind right now, being fluid, as my girlfriend says. Got to be fluid these days.
Yeah.
You just never know what's going to come towards you.
That's great.
If you were to give somebody, a young designer in San Francisco, a little advice, what's the one thing you would say to them?
I just say, trust your instinct, make things that make you happy, and also try to find an audience for it. There's all kinds of little fairs. There's the SF Made group also that hosts fairs and things like that. So try to participate and get the response from people. I mean, if you're making it for yourself, that's one thing. But if you're trying to make clothing to sell, then, you know, find an audience. Trust your instinct. And always get paid. Try to always get money in your hand before you give up the garment. I mean, that's just basic things, because you can get people that want things for free all the time and that will take you for all your worth, you know, if you
don't guard against it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also, if you smell a rat, probably is a rat.
Right.
Good advice.
That's right. Good there. Life advice.
Well, thank you for having us.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on Beyond the Fall Radio.
Yeah. Thank you.
I absolutely loved that interview. I loved how local Julie Weston is. I love that she knows the manufacturing side. She knows the cutters. She designed the fabric. I mean, that doesn't happen usually with designers. Usually the rest of it is farmed out. But this all stayed right here in San Francisco, and she kept her eye on the ball on every aspect of absolutely everything. And as things changed, she was able to change. So it was so fun to interview her and learn all about how she did all of that.
And especially how she did it all being a woman in an industry that was primarily pioneered by men. I mean, she got in there, she figured out how to create funding, and as we know, is very San Francisco in that way, to just kind of like hustle it and make it happen.
Yeah, and it's really great because she was part of an industry that was huge here in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, the building, the office that we are in now, used to be a garment factory. So it's totally a part of San Francisco's huge history. And what I love about Julie is that she not only is innovative and at the time saw something that she needed for herself and then sold it, but like Michaela said, she's scrappy, she hustles, and it's really a San Francisco specific story. And I love that we got the opportunity to meet Julie. And speaking of innovative people who are very San Francisco, next week, we end our fashion and design series with Stanley Gaddy, San Francisco's top event designer. Stay tuned for that.
Make sure that you check us out on Beyond the Fog Radio at Beyond the Fog Radio to see photos of Stanley and see what we're doing.
And please subscribe so that we can keep bringing you all of these amazing people. I mean, at this point, we really have quite a library of amazing, wonderful people who really tell the history of the area that we live in. You can find us on all of the podcast platforms.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Beyond the Fog Radio. And until next week, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Beyond the Fog Radio was produced by the three of us, Tim O'Shea, Tim Johnson, Arliss Hayes, and Connor Chang.
Beyond the Fog Radio, all rights reserved, 2022.